Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is a podcast from The Times, sports newspaper of the year.
Hello, I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and this is The Game, the audio supplement that perfectly complements the football supplement from The Times. This week, we've got something special for you because we're recording a show from the lovely studios at Absolute Radio. It's number one Golden Square if you want to drop by. By the time you get here, I'll probably be gone. But Russ Williams is joining me. He spends a lot of time here.
I do.
And I'm sure if you ring the bell, tell him you're here, he'll invite you up, show you around.
Absolutely.
Share some of his coffee with you. And we've got two of my favorite regulars here. We have Rory Smith, who's back from spending time, I believe, on some remote island. And this was by choice, Rory?
This was by choice, yeah.
This was by choice. Remarkable. And, of course, the poet at The Times. It's Mr. George Calkin from George's Gaff up in the Northeast. Later on, we'll be talking about domestic cup competitions, which ones are good, which ones stink. And we'll also see how much progress Liverpool are making. But let's start with Manchester United and Arsenal. Rory, you're back, so let's start with you. It wasn't 8-2, but it was pretty freaking dire if you're a Gooner, right?
Yeah, well, it probably wouldn't have been 8-2, but it might have been 6-1 or something. It was very, very poor. I find Arsenal bizarre, because if they win, people immediately talk them up as potential title challengers. There's been all this praise for Steve Bould and the defensive work he's done. Then they lose, and it's almost as though they're about to get relegated, and I find that very odd. Arsenal, to me, looked like a work in progress. They've looked like a work in progress all season.
Well, yeah.
And I think they'll be in the mix for fourth, but that says more about the Premier League than it does about Arsenal. I've never understood why people have been sort of talking them up so much.
It's interesting in your sister paper, The Sun, today, to read what Alan Shearer...
We don't like to be reminded of that, especially our boss,
okay,
Tony Evans. And he's a scouser and he's hard, so he might find you if you keep mentioning
that. We can edit
that.
Okay. Alan Shearer says that the problem with Arsenal is, and I think he's got a really good point, they have not replaced the players that have left, the RVPs, the Fabregases, the Nasris of this world. Even the Alex Song, who I thought was a really good player for them, with like individuals, if you like. And he maintains that that is Wenger's problem. I can't see them winning a trophy this season again. I just think that they looked wanting at Manchester United, and that used to be a game where they would turn up with all their World Cup winners, Arsenal, a few years ago. Times have changed.
George, we had an Alan Shearer mention there, so of course, by contract, I have to come to you. This thing, what Russ said is undoubtedly true. He hasn't replaced the players that he had with like for like, and he's replaced them arguably with worse players. I have to say, no disrespect, it might be true, but I don't think it's the actual most insightful comment I've ever heard from Alan Shearer. Or actually, it might be.
Hang on, are you sure about that?
Yeah, it might be. But I wanted to ask you actually about that, George. Isn't there a case to be made, though, that if Wenger believes in evolving, I mean, if you go back, for example, like 10 years ago, he had a very tall, physical team. Then he had a very sort of lightweight, agile team. If he wants to evolve and take his football in a slightly different direction, then if I'm playing devil's advocate, might it not be a good thing that I'm not replacing like for like? And also, if I'm replacing Robin van Persie, it's not really that easy to find another, you know, Robin van Persie like.
Well, I suppose you can put those two arguments together. You can say a few years ago we would praise Wenger for selling big players at you know, at the right time when they were at their peak, when people like Henri left, when people like Vieira left. We would sort of recognise that he was gaining as much money as possible for them, sort of, you know, sort of at the right time. Now he doesn't have that luxury, and they're being sold anyway. And whether you want to change tactics, formation, approach play, whatever you want to do, if you're constantly losing your best players or regularly losing your best players, you're not going to be able to do it. It's as simple as that, really, I think. Arsenal haven't had the chance to sort of adapt as much as they would do, because who are they building their team around? It changes season after season. So, I mean, I think that is a point. They haven't adapted as much as other teams have in the same period, but in some ways Wenger hasn't been allowed to do that.
What I would say is, I think you're absolutely right, Gab, that so when Wenger came in, he was trying to, he married continental technique with traditional British values of pace and power and all that, and he got that first-rate side. Then he tried to change it. He kind of wanted to be a bit like Barcelona, so he built it kind of around Fabregas, and it was tippy-tappy and really attractive football. The Arsenal of 5 years ago didn't play the same football as the Arsenal in 1998. The Arsenal in 1998, they were quite direct. They were pretty, but they were direct. They were a fast counter-attacking side. What is the philosophy at Arsenal now? What is he trying to build? Or has he just sold loads of players and he's bought whoever he can who might kind of fit? So Podolski, kind of the work ethic, Giroud theoretically is the goals, Chisholm is the creativity, but there's no sort of cohesive plan to Arsenal. I think that's what they're lacking.
Russ, I mean, help me here. If again, I don't want to totally go to bat for Wenger and what is his worst start I think ever in the Premier League, but on the back of the point Rory just made, if that's the case, that I mean, Cazorla, Podolski, Giroud, these guys are all new. Chamberlain's a kid. Wilshire's basically been gone for a year and a half. So you got to kind of integrate this. Dobby's hurt again.
Yeah.
Does that give him a way out? Is it this thing where we should trust in Arsenal? Well, not you, because you're not a gooner.
No, I'm not.
But if you were, I know it might be an uncomfortable jump to make.
It would be very uncomfortable for me. But
if you were, should you trust in Arsenal and say, well, it's just a question of getting these guys together?
You know, I've admired Arsene Wenger over the years, and you know, sensible Tottenham fans would fall into that category as well. But I think when I heard he signed Podolski, I thought, do you know what? I think he could do really well in the Premier League. I know that he didn't have a particularly good time at Bayern Munich, but for Germany he's an established goal scorer, he's got a good record, and I thought he's going to be dangerous for Arsenal. What does he do? He plays him on the left, where he's totally and utterly ineffective. Why would you buy a player who could be direct like Podolski and not use him properly? Doesn't
well,
make sense.
To be fair, he's played on the left
he's a striker for me.
But actually, that sets
they
me
need
up
goals.
That sets me up nicely for my transition, because we can't just spend the whole time lamenting how much Arsenal stink, because you know we've done that many times this season. But Rory, so this involves defending a South American foreigner, so I'm hoping my learned colleague will join me, even though it's a Brazilian and not a Uruguayan. But Andre Santos, he got absolutely slaughtered for the way he played. And he got slaughtered because he reached out for Robin Van Persie's shirt. Now, two things. First of all, look to me as if had a lot to do with the fact that Podolski, who people talked all season long, he works so hard. Look, he defends. He provides so much cover. In this game, for whatever reason, Podolski went walkabout into some like black hole down Michael Carrick's shorts and just disappeared. And it left Andre Santos time and again on his own. And you know, he's not that good to begin with. He can't handle it. The other thing, this business with the shirt swapping. So I'm sorry, who the hell are all these people who go and crucify Andre Santos? What the hell do you know? What, maybe he made a deal with Van Persie. Maybe he wants to auction the shirt off for charity, and then he was going to get it in the tunnel at halftime, which players do all the time, and he just happened to get it three paces before they disappeared down the tunnel. Are you as incensed as I am?
No, I don't think anyone is ever as incensed as you are, Gab, to be honest, about anything. No, not at all. I think you're right. It happens all the time. Players swap shirts.
At halftime in the tunnel.
At halftime in the tunnel. If they don't swap, they arrange who's going to get whose shirt, and it could be for charity.
Because guess what? Van Persie actually has two United shirts for the game, and he can swap it twice. One in the first half, one in the second half.
And it happens all the time. I think I'm surprised that, assuming Andre Santos isn't auctioning it off for charity, I'm surprised that professional footballers are bothered about getting each other's shirts. Andre Santos will have played in...
I'm pretty sure it is for charity, because guess what? Andre Santos is a nice guy. He has friends. He has people like, hey, can you get me a Van Persie shirt? Maybe it's his driver. Maybe it's his butcher. Maybe it's the guy who does his pedicures.
It may be his driver, because he's not allowed to drive himself, is he? So it might be him.
But surely, though, there's an image to this, and having certainly not played very well in the first half, whoever's fault that was, to be seen sort of asking for Van Persie's shirt as they're walking off the pitch together after a really difficult first half, you know, it does suggest that that's what he's thinking about, not his own performance, not the performance of the team. It's things like that that do wind supporters up, and you know, doesn't look great for a team that's kind of in a bit of difficulty. And you would hope that you have a bit more sense. And if it's going to happen, it would happen. Right. It would happen when the television cameras are not all over it.
Yeah, I think that's fair, and it is a bit stupid of Santos to do it in full glare. He's not. He shouldn't be doing that. It is inherently. I agree with you, Dab. I think it's inherently sort of distracting from the main issue.
But I didn't really care about it, if I'm honest. I didn't really spend any seconds thinking about it.
I'm glad there's somebody in the national media who hasn't, because it seemed like it was like, you know, he'd committed the worst offense in the history of mankind. Now, ordinarily, I get incensed, and I'm guilty of this too. Like when we have a game or there's a goal scored, that, you know, when you point out the negatives rather than bigging up the positives. And a very wise man, one Andy Gray, actually said that you should always big up the positives and then you can talk about the negatives. And I think he's right. In this case, though, United played very well. They could have scored a lot of goals. I find it hard, though, to talk about, because Arsenal were just so terrible. Apart from United's midfield, who I thought I thought they were very effective. But, I mean, at the back, yeah, Ferdinand and Evans, it looked to me like, you know, they could have been drinking margaritas back there, given Arsenal's attacking threat. Am I wrong here, Russ?
No.
George?
They could have been drinking margaritas in the black hole in Michael Carrick's shorts. I mean, it would have been... I'm not in love with Man United like I have been in previous seasons. I don't mean as a fan, because I'm not, but they're not irresistible, are they, yet? But they didn't need to be against Arsenal.
And they're sitting top of the Premier League without even getting going.
But you can read that two ways, can't you? You can read it as either it's great, just if they get better, then they defend that position, or it could be a false position. Because United can't defend.
No.
That is a problem.
That. Look at the Braga game.
Yeah, exactly.
Dreadful.
But then they're in a division where no one can defend, and possibly in a continent where no one can defend. That's a bit of debate, Gab.
Well, yeah, of course.
Can we defend in the Premier League, full stop?
Is it... Judge, that's what I was talking about. Let's get away from the negativity, which turns us all into mini wannabe Alan
Hansen. Well, it's positivity, because bad defending means goals, and that's what we want.
Yeah,
there you go. Russ, sorry, one more thing before we move on to we move on for this. Aaron Ramsey, what position is he playing, and why is he there?
Well, it's a very good question. You have a player who predominantly is on the right, and when Walcott is not playing, he's even further on the right, isn't he? He moves from the right of midfield to the right wing. And I watch him, and he's a frustrating player for me. You see flashes of real talent, I think, but not very often enough. And if I was Arsene Wenger, I'd be looking at that spot he occupies in that midfield for Arsenal at the moment.
Does he belong in the front three, Rory? I mean, does he have... I mean, I actually like Ramsey a lot. I think his personality, I think his technique, but... And I know yonks ago, you think he even played right back for
yeah,
Wales.
Yeah, yeah.
But playing out wide in a 4-2-3-1 or a 4-3-3, whatever you want to call it, is a completely different position. I can almost see the point, but it would be very un-Wenger-esque, as if you're there to neutralize, you know, the monster attacking left back. But, you know, Patrice Evra isn't Roberto Carlos anymore, assuming he ever was. What gives?
Well, I think partially because Wenger and Walcott have got this contract situation, which means Walcott's not playing.
But Arsenal have other players.
They do.
Walcott.
And I think Wenger likes the fact that Ramsey's quite economical in possession. He doesn't give the ball away a lot, but that's just he's very safe. I like Ramsey, but I like him in the central three. I think he's a good player in the central three. He's calm. He's quite composed. He's good. His vision's good. Out wide, he doesn't offer enough.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
That speaks to the problem that Arsenal have got. What is their plan? What's their system?
Well, they're going to win something in 2 years when fair play comes in. That's what their manager said.
Jam tomorrow.
And they're sitting on 70-plus million in the bank, which their fans find frustrating.
How funny would it be if Kroenke took all that 70 million out and used it to build more Walmarts? Now let's move on to Anfield, Liverpool and Newcastle, which is kind of cool because I think we have a Newcastle fan here and a Liverpool fan and a very objective Spurs fan. So it's a nice sort of balance here. But I looked at this, and I'll start with you, Rory, because, you know, I'll be the bearer of bad news here. Going into the weekend, I think it's right, Brendan Rodgers had one more point than your god Roy Hodgson did at the same stage 2 years ago. There's a stat that was tweeted yesterday, I believe by Ollie or Tony Barrett or somebody like that, who says that Liverpool have won 3 of 15 games at Anfield in 2012. That wasn't all Rodgers, that was some Dalglish as well. Is it that bad? Or tell me, in light of all this, why do the red masses all still have so much faith? Do they see a bright future ahead?
I think what's saving Rodgers to an extent is the fact there's so many kids in the team that fans generally, not just Liverpool fans, see young players coming through, and that they allow themselves to imagine that things will get better tomorrow, and that, you know, the future is bright, it's coming, they're building to something. I think there's an element of that with Rodgers. I think he's been let down by FSG and their financial planning in the summer, but I think he has to take a huge amount of responsibility himself. He had one attacking target in the summer, Clint Dempsey. When he didn't get him, he had no alternatives. That's an abrogation of responsibility to me. And also, yeah, I mean, I think the record generally is not good enough. There's, for all the talk of change and revolution and starting a new process, winning two games at home this season is just not enough. They've had a relatively difficult start. They've played all the sort of top six, top seven.
They haven't played Chelsea yet. They go there
except
next
Chelsea.
Week.
Except Chelsea, yeah.
I believe they haven't played Spurs.
They haven't played Spurs, but they've played.
Spurs are going to Anfield soon.
Yeah,
there you go.
They played five of the top seven, is what I meant. My apologies for my factual inaccuracy, which is not. It's not particularly difficult, but it's not entirely easy. Get to January, if it's still this bad at home, then I think he'll have a real problem. I think there is pressure coming on Rodgers.
Could he be the AVB of this season, Brendan Rodgers?
Well, if you talk to FSG, no, because they've said, sort of, they've briefed that he could lose every game and they wouldn't sack him. They see a plan. He's not lost every game. It's a good start.
AVB's assistant, of course, went on to win the Champions League. Do we even know who Brendan Rodgers is?
Colin Pascoe could win.
Could we see Colin Pascoe winning the Champions
League? Lifting the Premier League trophy at the end of the season, possibly.
Let's not rule
it out.
Risto, you've seen a number of rebuilding jobs, yes. Over, you know, as a fan in Spurs sort of long-term decline.
Thanks very much. That was provocative. No, it's true, actually.
The point Roy made about the kids, fans will never boo kids, right? They'll never turn on a team that's full of kids. That used to be sort of the old de facto rule. Is there also, though, a time, though, as a fan where you look at it and you say, like, I know what you're doing, manager. Like, these kids are clearly in over their head, and you're just doing this to save your own behind. Not suggesting that's what Brendan's done, but, I mean, have you seen somebody at Spurs or something, who you thought, this is what he's doing, isn't it?
Well, funnily enough, the current incumbent is the one who's played more young players, I think, probably in percentage terms, than certainly people like Redknapp. Even going back to the Glenn Hoddles of this world, I mean, you know, Santini and those short-term guys didn't really have time to make any impression there. I mean, Tottenham has a good reputation for producing good young players, I think, within the game. But, like a lot of clubs, have not really given many the chance that perhaps some of them have warranted. And I think, on a plus point for Andre Villas-Boas, when he's, you know, Stephen Colker, who is turning into, I think, quite a really notable central defender with a really good future ahead of him. You know, last season he couldn't get a look in. He was out on loan. And so AVB, I think,
he's learning the trade from Brendan Rodgers.
Progressive, yes.
And Ashley Williams.
But at least AVB is doing that. Now, there will be sections of the crowd like me who think, OK, this is good. I want to see the young players of the future. But there will be sections of the crowd who say, no, they're not good enough. They're not experienced enough. They're not going to help us achieve what we need is Champions League football. Well, let's see.
I think the thing about kids, just, I don't want to interrupt George, who's about to talk. I can feel it in my bones. But
what you just did.
What I think has been a problem in English football for quite a long time is that gap between 18 and 22, where the players develop in the academies or whatever. It's obvious that they're talented. They then don't get a chance at first team level, and that's cost.
If only there was a Premier League under 21,
which there is now, but there didn't used to be. Gap. Liverpool have sort of kind of bypassed that by just giving all these 17-year-olds a game, and that's great. Does it could? It will make or break them, but that within that there is a risk that it breaks them. If you've got Suso and Sterling, Andre Wisdom. Wisdom is a bit different, he's a little bit older. But Suso and Sterling, you have to protect those players. You can't play them week in, week out. You can't be throwing a 17-year-old kid on and saying, win us the game.
How many games has he played Sterling for Liverpool on the bounce? A lot.
Started pretty much every league game this season.
Let's talk about another manager who keeps doing it with smoke and mirrors, and he's up there. Your boy Alan Pardew. I just want to go back to this because we kind of, I don't know. I get the sense sometimes we don't always celebrate technique and technically gifted players unless they pay for the Sky 4. Ben Arfa and Kabai, I mean, I know Kabai goes off injured and whatever, and they might not do it all the time. These guys are really, really good, George.
They are, yeah. No, they really are, and it's been...
George, I'm going to jump in right here, right? You used to cover England, right?
Yes.
If these guys were English, and you were Roy, and you wanted the best for England, would they be in your England starting 11?
Hang on. If they were English and I was Roy... Well, terrific. they're fabulous players. Yeah, of course they would. I'm sure they would. I'm sure players of that quality would get in the England team if they were English. But if I had ham, I could have ham and eggs if I had eggs, if I was hungry.
That's right. And if your aunt had wheels, she'd be a bicycle.
But exactly. George, you can't because you're not allowed the calories.
No, not this week. But they're fabulous players. They've not played as well as they did last season so far this season. Pardew has sort of said all the way through so far, judges after 10 games. Well, it's 10 games now and they're, what are they, 10th place? And I think that's probably fair enough. They haven't hit the form that they did last season, but they've picked up some pretty decent results along the way. And it's cliche alarm bells ringing, but to be able to do that when they're not playing well suggests something else. I mean, last season, I won't say they were lucky because they weren't, because it was all based on quality and hard work, but things fell for them very nicely. And they haven't fallen for them quite so nicely this time. We saw them pick up injuries yesterday. But there is a resilience about them. So they are capable of digging out results. And, yeah, they've got some really, really fine footballers. What they haven't got is a deep squad.
That said, Colaccini, who I've sort of had this on and off relationship with, I mean, in purely platonic terms, of course, because, of course, this is a guy who was a superstar at a young age, went to a bunch of big teams, was absolutely terrible to the point that, you know, his name is still kind of a running joke in some teams. Then goes to Newcastle for a lot of money. At the time when, actually, you'll remind me, who bought him?
It was under Kevin Keegan, but the suspicion is that it was the hierarchy as opposed to...
And he goes there, and to me it looked like, oh, look, you know, they pulled a fast one here on Newcastle, you know, getting them this weirdo Harry Lum. And then he plays extremely well and totally, totally lives up to it. But then, of course, he goes down again because what was up with that kick on Luis Suarez, which looked to me totally unnecessary and just kind of a very foolish thing to do. Was there some running aggro between the two? I'm sure if there was, Rory will give a Suarez's view. Did that surprise you from a veteran player, a leader?
It surprised me a great deal because it was absolutely out of character.
Yeah.
And he's been a brilliant, not only a...
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're
you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Brilliant centre half. He's been a brilliant captain for the club, and you know, he is adored by supporters. He did have that terrible kind of start to his career, as many of them did at Newcastle at that time. But he's bounced back from that, and is a genuine leader, and seems a really, you know, a really good guy as well. So you presume it was a red mist moment. It's not something that he's done before or is likely to do again. He was troubled by Suarez throughout the whole game, as a lot of Newcastle players were, because he was so good. So I can only presume it was something like that. There's nothing malicious in him, and there certainly hasn't been anything malicious in him previously on the football pitch that I can recall.
The one final thing is, it's a point. And my Liverpool supporting but Brendan Rodgers hating acquaintance, who texts me occasionally, pointed out to me, oh, look at big stupid fathead. The winning goal is a hit, and our goal today was the result of a boot up the pitch from a player who Brendan Rodgers doesn't like and doesn't play, and that would be Jose Enrique. Any broader meaning to that? Is that kind of mean and unfair to Brendan?
I think it's interesting that Jose Enrique under Rodgers has turned into
Jose, he's not Portuguese,
a
man.
Pirate. If you look at the bald head and the massive beard,
Did he boot it up the pitch like that just to spite Rodgers, you think? Or was he trying to score a goal?
No, I think he'd seen the runner. I choose to believe he'd seen the runner Suarez, but I think the thing that we should all... Let's concentrate on the positives, Jab, as you say. Yeah. What a touch on his shoulder from Suarez. Super. What a touch that was.
Yeah, he's can play a little bit, that Luis Suarez. We did a whole segment on Suarez. We didn't even mention the word cheat once. I think we're making progress.
He was trying to handball it.
Exactly. I'm wondering if anybody here has cup fever, as in the FA Cup and the League Cup, which I'm tempted to call Carling Cup, just despite the current sponsors. It's interesting because there is a certain contrast here, right? The FA Cup is still seen as the serious competition. The League Cup is the one where, oh, it's all just a lot of fun because we'll play a bunch of guys we've never heard of and the game will finish 7-5, and then if we get to the semi-final, then we start taking it seriously. Which do you enjoy more, Russ?
Well, I think the Capital One Cup has been
extraordinary. He mentions the sponsors.
Extraordinary
name.
Entertainment.
That.
I've never had one of their credit cards, nor have I ever defaulted or been sued.
It's called the League Cup.
Yeah. Okay, let's call it the League Cup for Gabs. sensibilities.
Look, it's not a major sponsor. It's not like we're talking about the Barclays Premier League. The Barclays Premier League, which offers some of the it's the most exciting league in the world, many people feel.
Yeah.
Don't you agree, Roy?
Yeah.
I do not.
Well, is the Capital One Cup then the most exciting cup competition that we've got at the moment? The thing I like about it is that there's no replays, and I think that
Because it'll drag on forever.
Exactly, and I think the FA Cup really has got to have a look at that. I think they're important, the FA Cup and the League Cup, for, you know, this much vaunted pyramid of English football that we talk about that is so important, and I think it is in terms of bottom feeding the top. Unfortunately, the top, as time goes by, I don't think is that much interested in the bottom anymore. And so these competitions do keep that sort of contact going, and I think that they're both important competitions. But the FA Cup is, for me, it's not what it used to be.
Right, so I can see how the FA Cup keeps this sort of, we're all part of the pyramid thing going. But the League Cup, Rory, as I understand it, was created simply because a lot of football clubs installed floodlights and they're like, oh, look, we can now play at night, so let's go and invent this competition. And you don't really have small clubs in it. It's all, like, I mean, they're all, as the name suggests, they're all League Cups, right? They're all, right, yeah. All league sides, right?
Yeah, but I think so, if you said to Bradford, who are in the quarterfinals of Arsenal at home, that it's not important, I think they'd be very cross with you, very cross indeed, to be honest, because it's really important to Bradford. They're a League Two side, and they does keep that concept, and I think that is important. The problem for both is that, I guess, the mentality of football's changed, so now that the big clubs don't look at either cup as being especially worthwhile. It doesn't hurt. You're a Spurs fan, Russ, when you go out of the car and whatever it's called.
When they lost at Norwich.
But it doesn't hurt like a league defeat does.
Because I've been told by our manager that we were taking all competitions very seriously.
But it doesn't hurt like a league defeat does. It doesn't sort of, you don't get that pit of your stomach feeling when your team loses in the league.
Well, no. The weekend wasn't great.
You just think, well, it's only whatever it's called, now the Rumbelows Cup.
George, this is the part of the programme where, of course, I bring up the fact that Newcastle haven't won anything since the Texaco Cup, which I don't know. Maybe
how
you
long
can,
goes that?
I'm sure George will tell us what the Texaco Cup was or is. People bring this stuff up, but if it was that easy, wouldn't Alan Pardew play his best 11 in the League Cup and just focus everything on that and deliver the much-needed silverware? And then, I mean, do we sort of patronize fans when we talk about, oh, they all want silverware and a cup run, and look, they haven't won anything since XYZ?
Well, I mean, managers get sucked into the kind of same thing, it seems to me, whichever club it is, whatever their stature. I mean, I suppose I'm talking about Premier League clubs now, because, you know, at the start of the season, Alan Pardew said, you know, first priority is Premier League, getting it back into the top 5, 6, 4. And I've kind of had this debate with enough people to realise that I think I'm increasingly, you know, I'm increasingly sort of out of touch, really. But as someone who's watched North East football for 40 years, I would take a trophy any season, and finishing 17th in the Premier League, that would count for me as a brilliant, brilliant season. But I think people less and less would take that now, and I've had that conversation with directors at Newcastle. I've had that conversation with fans who travelled over to Maritimo in the UEFA Cup a few weeks ago, and they said no. I mean, they were young enough to have only experienced one relegation, and that was so haunting that they didn't even want to finish 17th, because it would sort of raise memories of that. So I don't know. I think kind of priorities change as years go by. I think that's quite sad. The original kind of question I find in some ways flawed, because I was at I was at the Stadium of Light last week for Sunderland against Middlesbrough in the Capital One Cup, and it was dreadful from a Sunderland perspective. That certainly wasn't a goal fest. It wasn't much fun. Middlesbrough were very, very good, and Martin O'Neill played a really, really strong side. It was something he was obviously targeting. He's got a decent record in the competition, and it was, but you know, from a Sunderland perspective, it was pretty grim, and it's led really for the first time for kind of questions to be being asked about O'Neill at Sunderland. So it does still, cup competitions do still have the power to sort of reinforce or or bring negativity.
In terms of the milk cup, the problem with the milk cup has is that we're allowed to advertise milk. It's just a thing, isn't
absolutely.
It? Just a thing that exists. The milk cup's problem isn't that the top six don't take it seriously. Does that? I suspect that probably was always the case, that United's and Arsenal's and Liverpool's, when they were half decent, weren't that bothered by the League Cup, especially if they were in Europe. I think the problem is that you look at sides like Stoke and Sunderland, and that sort of ilk of sides, West Brom, the teams who aren't really going to go down, or they certainly shouldn't be looking at going down, they're putting out weakened sides. Why are they putting out weakened sides? Is finishing 8th really that much better than finishing 11th
in
the Premier League?
I don't think Sunderland did this week.
I don't think they have,
which is probably what makes it even more disappointing.
Yeah, so that's maybe... But you take my point, George, generally.
They are the exception.
Those teams who are going to finish between, say, sort of 7th and 13th don't seem bothered by it. And you sort of think, what is the point of you playing football?
You see, the thing is then Newcastle finished 5th last season, and they get into Europe, and we all say what a fine achievement it is, and then in the first game they make 10 changes, and I mean they've done very well so far, and they're top of the group and playing Bruges this week, and hopefully they'll kind of progress, but you kind of, it's wow, this is a great achievement, and then it's oh my God, I'm looking at 10 footballers who I don't recognise.
Well, that was always the thing with Redknapp at Spurs, that he seemed to get into the Europa League so that he could get knocked out of it in the last 16.
Yeah.
Which is a very odd way of going about your business.
I was trying to think who won the League Cup last year, or the Worthington Cup, since that's one sponsor we haven't mentioned yet from the past.
Littlewoods.
I think we've covered all. Yes, thank you.
Littlewoods.
Worthington and Littlewoods. It took me a while of thinking about it. I'm assuming you guys all know, Russ?
He'd know.
Yeah, well, he would know, but do you know?
Yeah, Liverpool.
Thank you. George, did you know Liverpool won the League Cup last year?
Of course I bloody well knew that.
No, seriously.
There is no more romantic way to win a competition than beating a championship side on penalties.
Well, but...
I was Googling it, but...
yeah, and it certainly did wonders to help their manager keep his job.
Absolutely,
as well.
Yeah.
But it just kind of struck me, and what you guys said about it's about winning silverware, and I think, and I must be in a complete minority, and hey, hit us up on Twitter or email Game Podcast and tell me how insane I am. I don't think it is about winning.
No, come on. It's not about winning things. I'm sorry, it's not about winning things. It's about glory, or it's about trying to win things.
Exactly, but
I lived in the North East. I've seen Sunderland won the FA Cup in 73, Middlesbrough won the whatever cup, League Cup it was called then, and that's all I've seen. It's not about winning things. Winning things is overrated, clearly.
Well, you saw Newcastle win the championship, right?
Yes, but it's about striving, it's about glory, it's about trying to, it's about the eternal hope that one day, finally, maybe the team will win something. It's not about finishing 9th in the Premier League.
By the way, the point I was making is, it's not about winning things, it's not silverware. I think it's about going and supporting your team and watching them every game and thinking about them and the anticipation, and regardless of what competition they're playing in or what they're doing. Winning, you know, it's, if you have more money, you generally tend to win over time. If you have less money, you generally tend not to win over time. It can't be about winning silverware, because otherwise I'll go set up my own tin pot competition. And, you know, that's why, for me, what they should do is just get rid of the League Cup and allow teams more time to train. And so we see a better product, fewer injuries, our best players play for longer, and everybody's happier.
But isn't the great thing about the League Cup as well that it's over early in the season?
Yep.
It's out of the way.
That's like saying, I like this book because it's really short.
Well, no, but
if it's good, you want it to be long.
It starts early, it finishes the back end of February. You know, it's a nice little sort of pick me up for the rest of the season. I think it's great. The FA Cup's underway. What's the matter with you?
I like this theory, because don't you have to win? I think Newcastle would have to win 17 games to get to the final of the Europa League or whatever it's called now, and that's far too long. Let's make football shorter.
I can't argue with you people. Yes. Why don't we make football matches 20 minutes and then they'll be done?
It's been spoken about before.
Exactly. All right, enough of this. Time for some quick hits. Chelsea concede a late equaliser to Swansea, and it cost them first place in the table. Rory, we've done more than enough talking about Chelsea this season. Tell me instead what Michael Laudrup is doing right, and don't just tell me he's building upon all the hard work Brendan Rodgers did before him.
Well, he's not. I think he's changed the emphasis slightly to a more attacking, more open style. I think Rodgers occasionally indulges in what Wenger calls sterile domination, but I don't want to talk about Michael Laudrup. He's a good manager. Swansea will be a bit crazy this season. Pablo Hernandez is a brilliant footballer. What a bargain that is. Four million quid from Valencia. He's a top class right winger. He'll be playing for a top four side within 2 years.
Will it be Swansea?
No.
That'd be a good story. Everton are up in fourth place, and while they may have been lucky on some occasions this season, they were decidedly unlucky in their 2-2 draw with Fulham at the weekend. George, I'll be the first to say that I was expecting them to fall away. But what if they don't? And just tell me, how does David Moyes keep it fresh after a whole decade at Goodison?
If they don't, we should declare a national holiday. they're very good, and Moyes is very good, and you can have seasons like Newcastle did last time where things can run for you, they can fall in place, and even if you've got a small squad and not much money, you can be the beneficiaries of that. How does Moyes keep doing it? He's really a very, very good manager, and the limited funds that he does get, he uses it to buy and find very, very good footballers.
I won't tell him, okay, you said this, but would you swap Pardew for Moyes? Shh, nobody's listening. Just me and you, George.
No.
Oh, you are all right. You don't need to answer that. You don't need to answer that. Alan's very sensitive. Manchester City also dropped points, drawing with West Ham. And in fact, they were also rather fortunate that a perfectly good Kevin Nolan goal, followed by an aborted chicken run celebration, was disallowed. That meaning that the celebration was aborted, not the chicken. Russ, Mario Balotelli was crucified once again. And once again, I feel compelled to tell the world to stop picking on him. You're one of the few people who's appeared on this podcast who has yet to weigh in on Super Mario. What's your take?
I'm a big fan of Mario Balotelli. I think the
man after my own heart.
You have to bear in mind where he's come from. He is a foster child, and the problems that go with that mentally. He's fallen out with his birth parents, who tried to come to him when he was doing well in Italy. And I think Mancini has been a really nice arm around him. And I think that he loves Balotelli on and off the pitch, but also tells him when he's not doing so well. For me, he's an extraordinary talent. He's not an expensive penalty taker. He's very good at those, and I'd play him if Mancini knew his first 11. I would definitely play him, but I don't think he does.
Mancini definitely does not. Yes, and that's a message to MOTD crew, okay? I think you'll find that Mario Balotelli's achieved more at his age than the three of you achieved at your age. I don't remember you guys scoring two goals against the hated Germans in a European Championship semi-final. I don't remember you guys winning Champions League titles at his age. I don't remember you guys winning league titles in two different countries. So basically, shut the f*** up! QPR are joint bottom of the table, and some are calling for Mark Hughes's head. Our paper says the specter of Harry Redknapp hangs over Loftus Road. Rory, I know you didn't write that headline, but I was thinking, is Harry just really such a sepulchral, spectral figure? I find him quite cheery, actually. But would swapping Sparky for Harry be a change for the better?
I think that'd be great if the face of Deputy Dodd was kind of beamed over Loftus Road at night. I don't think it would.
Deputy who?
Do you not think Harry Redknapp looks like Deputy Dodd?
The Jowls.
The Jowls.
Yeah.
The Jowls.
Who's
the
Deputy? Is this, is this some Anglo reference?
He's an
getting?
Iconic cartoon character.
Yeah.
You should have watched more television in your upbringing, Gabriele.
I'm sorry.
Were you watching?
I was reading books and watching Polish and French films and being a generally pretentious snothead. But
When we were watching cartoons, you were watching Croatian second division matches, weren't you?
Indeed, yes.
Yeah. I think I'd stick with Hughes. I've got to admit, I think Hughes is a decent manager. I think he knows what he's doing at the bottom end of the table. QPR have got a decent squad. They've got a good midfield in Dronero and Fowling. If they can click, that's a really good midfield. I'd give him more chance, but the amount of money they've spent, the transfer policy was completely crazy in the summer. I think that Hughes needs a very quick turnaround. Redknapp, would get QPR playing nice football, but I don't think it would be the right appointment for them. I think they maybe need someone who doesn't want to spend money constantly.
Maybe they need a strong director of football. Maybe you should appoint Kia Jerapchin as director. Oh.
No comment.
Now, if I read the stat in the paper correctly, Sunderland have won one of their last 17 games. Martin O'Neill himself pointed out that they were doing horrible this time last year, and everything sorted itself out. Wondering if I should be rude and remind him that the way they fixed it last year was that they sacked the manager and appointed somebody named Martin O'Neill who fixed things. Now, of course, that's not an option they have now. That would be kind of nonsensical, and you'd be caught in some sort of weird, infinite Mobius loop that you would never get out of. So, George, what is the solution?
They're half awful, half very solid. The stats are correct. They won one of the last 17 in the league. They've drawn 11 of those games. Some of them were last season when they were safe and had nothing left to play for. But the big issue for Sunderland is that their three creative players aren't being in the slightest bit creative. Sessegnon, McLean, and of course the big one really is Adam Johnson, who's been very, very disappointing since he signed from Manchester City. I don't think it's anything more serious than a case of form, but when you get in a run like the kind of run they're in, that can become entrenched, and then it doesn't matter about niceties such as that really. So they need to start showing how good they are or they're in trouble.
Spurs are tied for fourth in the table, but it was boos all round for Andre Villas-Boas when he sent on one striker, Emmanuel Adebayor, for another striker, Jermaine Defoe, with Spurs a goal down. Russ, this question was originally put to Rory, who likes to defend foreigners who do weird things like not play with two strikers at home. I'm assuming you have a more sensible view.
Well, I think that whoever your manager is, if you're a supporter of the club, within reason, you have a duty to at least give them a go. I think there's sections of the media, certain sections of the fans who are not interested in Andre Villas-Boas succeeding. I think he's done pretty well. They're joint fourth in the Premier League at the moment. Poor result of the weekend at home where they haven't been great. But this is the team that went to Old Trafford for the first time in 28 years and beat Manchester United 3-2. You do not do that unless your players want to play for you. So for the people writing and suggesting the players are not behind him, I would say that is not true. But he must start playing two strikers at home. Adebayor and Defoe. They're a match made in heaven for each other. Why won't he do it?
Who do you drop?
I wouldn't play Sigurdsson.
Or Dempsey.
I don't think Clint's played that well since he's come to the club. I think there's better to come.
Yeah, but one for you. I hear and have read that Juventus' 49-match unbeaten streak came to an end on Saturday night, I think, rather than Sunday night.
It was Saturday night. Skinner, you were the wrong thing here.
Our producer's written the wrong thing. Yeah. Also, his spelling.
Gab wrote that.
His spelling and punctuation are awful. How did it happen? And can you give us some historical context?
Well, it happened because they ran into an Inter side who played out of their skin in very unlikely circumstances. They went there with three strikers and three not exactly high work rate strikers at that. And they came back despite going a goal down after 18 seconds and absolutely battered them. It was a victory for Andrea Stramaccioni. If you lot didn't have such a difficult time mentioning his name or pronouncing that name, I'd say remember the name because he's only 36 years old. And so far, he looks like a special manager. Interesting thing about Juventus' 49-match unbeaten streak, I looked around to see who had longer streaks. Worldwide, it's actually ASEC Mimosas, who went 108 games unbeaten.
Famously.
Steaua Bucharest went 106 games unbeaten, but that's a bit of an asterisk there because it was Romanian football in the 1980s and Ceaușescu's son and so on. You had Celtic, 62 games unbeaten, but of course that was during in the midst of World War I where players were kind of disappearing every week to go and fight in the trenches. And you've got a whole bunch like Sheriff Tiraspol, guys like that. In the big European leagues, the record remains 58 games unbeaten for AC Milan, and I think, and that's followed by Juventus 49, and of course, Arsenal 49. I think that really stands out because at the time, Serie A was, I think, indisputably the best league in the world, and they went 20% longer than anybody else in a major league. That's all we've got time for this week. It's been fun. Come find us on Twitter to share your thoughts or email gamepodcast@thetimes.co.uk. A special thanks to Russ, who was kind enough host us here in his home in Absolute Radio. Russ, when can people hear you?
My normal show, 10 o'clock in the morning, but of course, rock and roll football Saturday afternoon and Barclays Premier League coverage every Saturday.
Saturday afternoon from when to when?
1:30 right the way through to 7, including him. Right from 5.
There you go. Ian, right. You can go to thetimes.co.uk. You'll find your news, your gossip, your analysis, our web chats. Rory's web chat is on Mondays usually, which means by the time you get this, you're going to have to plan ahead to next Monday if you want to chat with Rory on the web. There's also our blogs. George's blog is generally the best blog of the week. George, when is your blog?
Last week.
Last week. There you go. So you have to put that in your calendars. I have a blog coming up this week as well. Till next time. Bye-bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host
Niñas Bien Podcast. We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish, but you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.